You're listening to the Men Overseas Podcast, a show that explores methods and ideas to help you live a bigger life. You will hear interesting stories of how people live, how they save and invest their money, and why having time wealth is better than being a billionaire. If you are entertained, educated, or elevated, be sure to hit the subscribe button. We're just getting started. Now here is your host, Brad D'Antonio.
Guess who's back? Back again.
Do you realize you're one of the more listened to guests I've had? This is your third time.
Yeah, third time's a charm.
You think? We're going to hit it off?
I think we're going to go even higher this time.
Dang! All right. Well, we're in Sugarland for listeners. And you always get to stay in really nice hotel rooms, and I'm jealous of this. You could sleep at least four in here, but it's always just you.
Yeah, I got two beds this time because my family was going to maybe come, but I usually have one bed, but... Either way, it is nice. We stay in some really, really nice hotels and really cool cities. I'm pretty fortunate.
How often does the fam travel with you?
They've come to Sugarland a few times, Oklahoma City. They've come to Vegas. They might come to Vegas again this year. And I want to get them out to Reno and to Tacoma and Albuquerque. It's hard to fly three people around. But it is nice to have a hotel room you don't have to pay for once you get there.
Yeah.
Especially Vegas. Vegas is like... five-star resort out in like West Vegas. The field is out in I can't think of the name of the city, but hotel's right across from the stadium, and it's, you know, there's 27 pools, and it's a really, really big league hotel. So they've come out there one time before.
My brother was at a conference at the Red Rock Hotel and Casino one time.
That's it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Bam. I'm glad you thought of it. See? That's the one. Did he say it was baller?
I went. It was baller.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. Okay. So the stadium, you saw the baseball stadium right across the street?
This was 2007.
It wasn't there?
No.
So the Red Rock out west of town, right? It was, yeah, the hotel was there? I didn't know it was that old. I thought it was newer than that.
It was brand new at the time. Okay. I think there's an amphitheater there where a lot of concerts are held.
I think so. Yeah. Hmm. So now the AAA stadium's right across the street, and it's really built up around there now, too. So it's a great spot.
Do you ever... go to cities and make note of this could be a future employer and therefore like take notes on where you might want to be in the future?
Yeah. I mean, you're always kind of networking with other coaches and organizations. You wonder what if maybes, but I mean, I guess I've been in pro ball long enough to know that it's hard to really predict where you're going to be. You got to try and be where your feet are, but yeah, I mean, you wonder what it's like for the other team to live there, like as players and coaches. Do they like living in Salt Lake City, Utah? Like, I feel like I would, because I love visiting it, but you never know as being there as your home team what it would be like.
Is that the kind of thing that people talk about, like on first base?
I'd say so. Yeah, yeah, that's a good question. I was a bit of a talker, and it's usually just pleasantries. How you doing? What's going on? What's up? Maybe in my younger days, like, what's the good bar spot around here? You know, maybe talk along those lines. Everybody's really complimentative. Like, you know, good swing, good stroke. You know, looking good. How's the fam? You know, it's nothing too crazy. But usually after the pleasantries, you got to dial it in and get the signs and try not to make a bad base running decision.
The video you sent me yesterday of the guy getting called up. Tell me about that dude.
He's one of my all time favorites. He's the Division III, you know, 15th rounder that didn't really have much of a chance to get to the big leagues. But to his credit, he just hit and he hit and he hit, and step by step, he got promoted through the system, and along the way, he endeared himself to every teammate and coach. He plays the game the right way. He's a great teammate, great human being. So you're always pulling for him, and you wonder when that day is coming, because he's done enough to prove himself, but it's always timing, right? When's the guy struggling? When's the guy hurt to give him the opportunity? We thought it was going to come last year, and it didn't come. So you feel for him, and you hope that, you know, as someone that didn't get that break, you wonder, like, man, is he going to be one of the guys like me that just didn't get that lucky break? But it broke for him yesterday, and we kind of knew about it. We got the team together, and it's the moments that, you know, you kind of live for in this position as to being a AAA coach, where you're in on the conversations or the announcements that change people's lives. I mean, that's his lifelong goal and dream since he was a child, and to see the raw emotions of it, to see his teammates react to it, and, you know, the phone call to the wife and the phone call to the parents. It's all the stuff you've seen. And it's even cooler when you're you're one of the first people to give him a hug. And, you know, and he's genuinely appreciative of his teammates and his coaches and the people that have poured into him to get him to that point. I mean, that's our job, is to develop big leaguers. So when we do that with guys that you've developed relationships with, it's not far off from calling your own son up to the big leagues. I mean, it is absolutely the rest of the day. I don't even know, you know, it was kind of a, you know, fog for all of us, because we were also, you know, just high on elation of just so happy for Blaine that, you know, we did it. We got him there, and he's forever a big leaguer. If he goes and goes, doesn't get a hit, gets a hit, stays 10 years, stays 10 days, like forever for the rest of his life, he's a Major League Baseball player, which is fantastic.
It's funny you say that, because I introduced Jamie Bubella to my wife, and yeah. I was like, this is the big leaguer from our...
When he's from small town Mobile, Alabama, like if he's in Mobile, like that's how he'll be introduced for the rest of his life.
That's awesome. You mentioned being a good human being. How important is that? And my next question would be, how different is the path to the big leagues now that you're on the inside? Like, how different is it from what you thought it was before you had ever seen anybody called up to the big leagues? Like, did you think they had to never make an error or never strike out? How has that changed?
Yeah, perspective changes a little bit. And to your first question, you know, being a good person, I feel like really helpful, because it buys you time. It buys you opportunities to maybe struggle, and people are going to stick their neck out for you, and they're going to maybe give you a little more time, or they're going to, you know, maybe promote you based off of you, them knowing you're going to be a professional. You're not going to be a distraction. You're going to be an adder. You're going to make other people around you better. So even if Blaine was never in their plans to be in their major leagues, he was in their plans as being a good influence on maybe their guys that are prospects, even though Blaine wasn't. And so that ties into your value. I mean, you're always being evaluated, and you always have, you're like a stock. Like, is your stock going up? Is it going down? And you don't want it to be just purely dependent on your production, because production can go up and down. So you want to have something that's a baseline, that you have a value, whether it be maybe your defense, maybe your base running. Like, so there's tools to have. And as a first baseman that just hits, like he didn't have to be, but it helped that he was also a tremendous human being and a great teammate, and exemplified our standards and our pillars and made our organization better, because that just, you know, adds to his value. And so when there's conversations about you, Blaine, or whoever, there's biases. There's people that are pulling for him. They're maybe going to push a little harder for him to get promoted or get opportunities. So it's massive. I don't see why everybody doesn't do that. As someone that was like Blaine, that tried to endear myself to my teammates and coaches, like you're raising your value, and the inverse of that is self-sabotage. Like, you're sabotaging your opportunity. You have an opportunity to play this game and make life-changing money and do something that not many people get to do. Why would you sabotage that by being a cancer or by being a subtractor? So I guess it didn't come easy for me, but I saw that clearly. And I knew from early on, like this can be one of my calling cards. This can be my sixth tool, because I only have a certain amount of speed and arm strength and power. Like, what else can I do? And I think Blaine probably saw it the same way, but, you know, it's not everybody's built like that. And sometimes there's some entitlement that gets in where guys think that they're on a forever scholarship, but the scholarship runs out. Even first rounders, like after a few years, a first round tag kind of falls away, and you're expected to be a major league producer. And if you're not, or you don't have value in the industry for a trade or anything, like, I mean, there's been three or four drafts since you were a first rounder. So it's like, the churn keeps happening. So it's interesting to watch from the inside looking out now that I'm a coach. And I did think maybe when I was a player, like I had to do more, but I think that was also probably helped me. Like, I'd never let up. I never took a bat for granted. I was always felt like I was on borrowed time. So it probably helped me like always be engaged. But now I see that the timing component and the so many moving parts, and like, you can't just call a guy up because he's hot. Like, there's roster moves, and there's this, there's that, there's so many things that go into it that you don't have control over, that I see now better than I did when I was a player. Cause I just felt like it was unfair. I'm like, well, it's not necessarily unfair. It's just the way this mechanism is constructed to, you know, you can't just have unlimited roster spots and do whatever you want and bring a player up. Like, it's not that you're going to lose someone to call that player up. So you got to designate a player, which means he may go out of the organization. So it's a lot of moving parts.
So he's got some time to be productive at first before they move Seager to first base.
We'll see how it all shakes out. But he'll get some rope. He'll get some at bats. And the guy that they sent down for him to get a bit of a reset, you know, he's an established big leaguer that's had multiple 30 home run seasons.
Who is that?
Yeah. Jake Berger. You know, we traded for him, and he's been off to a rough start, and he's going to come to Round Rock and get, you know, the 10-day minimum is when you have to be down, and he'll get some at bats and hopefully find, you know, some things and who knows what happens from there. But I mean, Blaine's always said, just, you know, he's a good old boy from Mobile. He's like, give me 10 at bats. You don't like what you see. Like, I'll go, you know, I'll be fine. Like, he doesn't, you know, he's fine either way, which is what's beautiful about him is that he has such a good grasp of everything that he's not defined by baseball. He's got a wife, beautiful wife. He's got a good faith, you know, foundation in his faith. So he had a better perspective than I did. I was, my identity was tied into my baseball in a lot of ways. So I held on to it so tight that he has a maturity about him that's like, he loves to play and he of course wants to get to the big leagues, but it's not, he'd be fine if he didn't go to the big leagues, you know, and his perspective has allowed him to play really well and he's gotten the opportunity because of it.
Is he a lefty?
No, right-handed hitter, first baseman.
What's his last name?
Krim, C-R-I-M.
Blaine Krim?
Yep.
I'll be pulling for him.
Yeah, he's an easy one to pull for. He's 5'10", first baseman, you know, doesn't run that well, doesn't have a great arm. Like, defense has been a work in progress, but he's just the little engine that could. He's a plotter.
So last time you were on, Bubba Thompson had just gotten called up?
Yeah.
What's his status now?
So it's funny, the Bubba and Cole Reagans, who's a perennial Cy Young candidate now, are both called up from Sugar Land. So I guess there's something in the water here in Sugar Land that there's been some special memories for some of our more fond players that we've developed. But Bubba went on to play in our big leagues. He played in the big leagues with the Reds. He actually made the team out of spring training last year, struggled, sent down, and then struggled again in the minor leagues, was a free agent. And from what I understand, like, he had a hard time getting another job in baseball. So the school that he originally had committed to play college football and baseball, because he was a, you know, 4-star quarterback recruit, reached out and asked if he still wanted to play football. So he didn't have any real offers for baseball. And he said, you know, with what they're paying with NIL, and I could, you know, have a chance to make big league money playing college football. So he's playing for University of Alabama, Birmingham. Yeah. So I saw him showing videos of him playing, you know, throwing passes, and with his speed, I can't help but think he'd be a menace on the field. And, you know, if he goes and kills it and some major school in the SEC or somewhere else sees it, and like, who knows what he could turn into. I mean, he's one of the fastest human beings I've ever seen. Maybe the fastest.
Do you know where he is on the depth chart at UAB?
No.
No.
No, I don't know what the plans are, if he's just going to like be thrust into it or learn free. I don't know the details, but I do know that he's not one to bet against, having known Bubba, that, you know, he'll separate himself with not just his speed, but the way he goes about it, his preparation and everything.
How do you keep in touch with him?
Yeah.
How do you decide who to keep in touch with? There's so many guys.
It's a good, I actually have a list I wrote in my journal of, like, I call them, I read somewhere, they're called like Timothy's, like your mentees, the people that you feel like have impacted their life and vice versa. And it's not like I set a calendar date and like reach out to him, but I just, you know, when people are on my heart or I see a picture, I share it. If I shoot a deer, he loves to hunt. If I catch a fish, he likes to fish. I'll send him that, you know, the Christmas letter I write every year, Blaine, I think I texted him last night, the video of Blaine, cause he knows and loves Blaine. So, you know, to share that video with him, you stay in contact, and, you know, social media, you see what's going on in people's lives. So I try not to get too far away from the guys and just at least maybe send them a text and, you know, just to stay in contact, because they do kind of come, not become your children, but in a way they're you're forever tied to these kids that you're with for years and hours, hundreds and thousands of hours.
Did you ever tell the T-Mac cheese puff story on the podcast?
Good segue.
Have you? No,
I don't think so.
That's the best story ever.
You like that one?
Yes. Yeah. Please share.
Do you want to hear it?
Yeah.
All right. So T-Mac is Tracy McGrady, for the people listening, who was a 7-8-time All-Star in the NBA.
And at the time, I think when his career ended for the Rockets, he was making $20 million a year. That was just playing basketball.
Yeah, and he's not counting endorsements, not counting. He's been really smart with his money business-wise, so I think he's 2 or 3x that maybe. Who knows? Either way, he always dreamed of playing baseball, and his first true love was baseball, kind of like Michael Jordan. So when he got done with basketball, he wanted to give it a shot. And living in Houston, there was an independent team called the Sugar Land Skeeters, which we're here now. Before they were an affiliated team, they were a independent team. So I was playing for them at the end of my career, trying to get picked back up into affiliated ball. And he talked to someone and got on the team. And, you know, he was a teammate. He was my locker mate right next to me. And so we got a guy that's, you know, worth $100 million playing on an independent baseball team. And he got a chef. We had a chef in the clubhouse, and we'd, you know, we'd go on party buses and eat these big dinners on the road. So we were living like big leaguers because of T-Mac, but he was great. He was one of the best teammates I ever had because he never complained. He never, you know, he wasn't too good for the 6 a.m. Southwest flight. He wasn't too good for the Motel 6. He'd get the honeymoon suite with the heart-shaped hot tub. So we'd go into T-Mac's room and he'd have, you know, 6'10" guy in this heart-shaped bathtub and the bed that you put a quarter in, and it vibrates. And he could have gotten his own, room wherever, but he rode on the bus back, for a 7-hour bus ride. He's there playing cards and with the boys. So he was wonderful. And so we got somewhere. The travel was awful. We were always having to wake up at 3 a.m. to go fly to the Northeast, and you get flying layover here, there, and you're just a zombie and you're so hungry. We got to the field one day and I hadn't eaten, and they had one of those tubs of cheese balls on top of the fridge in the food room. I love me some cheese balls, and I just casually said I could eat that whole thing.
You are a cheese ball. You are what you eat, right?
It's like chips in general. Like salty snacks are like my vice. So I guess, if you could have a vice, that's probably not a bad one to have. So like I could eat the whole tub, and it's the one that's like, this wide. Yeah, the Costco tub. And he's like, I bet you couldn't. And I was like,
I've learned never to challenge you that way.
Yeah, probably not a good idea. You're at least going to get my best effort. So he said, I don't know if he said 5 grand or 10. He said 5 grand. 5 grand says you can't. And I said, that tub will be consumed. So I get it down. Things start kind of spreading around the clubhouse. I'm going to crush this tub. I don't care if I miss BP or not, or he can't play for the game. Like,
you think he had 5 grand on him?
100%. He had a bodyguard that traveled with him that had a briefcase or a duffel bag that was heavy with cash,
just in case he went to the strip club.
I don't know. Yeah, man, I don't know where he was going, but he was strapped with security and cash. I don't know. You have to ask T-Mac. But so I get the tub down, and all of a sudden my teammates for some reason start putting like parameters on this bet, which I'm still kind of mad about. Like, well, why would you put a time limit? So they made like an hour, and then they made it like a certain amount of water I could have. And I'm like, I'm gonna have a bunch of water, and I'm just gonna go like Coney Island hot dog competition here. And I'm just going to like
gorge
with you let the water kind of, they kind of dissolve in water anyways. I'm just going to make a cheese ball smoothie and down this thing. So I'm getting frustrated, but I'm like, time's ticking. We got to get going. So I start crushing and like 20 minutes go by, 30 minutes go by. And
are you putting 8 in your hand or how are
yeah,
you?
Yeah. I'm like kind of handful, like, minis can fit in my mouth and it's just chewing. And like, I got in a pretty good rhythm, but the time was going faster than the bucket. Like I wasn't feeling optimistic, but like, I'm going to go the whole hour. And if I'm short, I'm short. Like, I'm not just going to throw my hands up because that's not how the kid's built. So, so after like 20, 30 minutes, guys start doing their things. They're like, the novelty factor had kind of worn off. Now I'm just the weird guy in the corner that's turning like colors. I'm like orange, but I'm turning green because I'm starting to get sick. And T-Mac's watching me, like feeling bad for me. And after about 40 minutes, and there's still about a half a tub left. And he's like, man, I'll give you a grand just to stop. Because I think I was turning a weird shade of color. And I was like, orange hand right up for the shake. And he's like, knuckled me up. And he's told his security guard, 10 crispy $100 bills right there.
Security guard counted it out.
Right there. Bam, bam, bam. 10 crisp, like never touched hundos. So $1,000 for the fam.
How about that?
Yeah.
I probably would have kept it and framed it or something. Get him to sign it.
Yeah. Ricky Henderson tried that. He got a contract for $1 million and framed it. The bank called him like a year later and they're like, our numbers, our books aren't adding up. What'd you do with that $1 million? He's like, right here on the wall.
I remember, so we played against Josh Beckett in high school, and I remember running into him and some friends after we graduated, and one of them was telling us that he would go to his house where he went to high school in spring and see like a $150,000 check that hadn't been cashed from 3-4 months ago.
Yeah.
What's the biggest amount of money you've ever seen like that?
I think it was with Scott Kazmir. Mm. And he got his installment for his signing bonus. I think he signed for $2.1 million. He got like a $600,000 check, and we were going to go hit at the field or throw at the field or work out or something. And so I picked him up, and he's like, you mind swinging by the bank? I got to make a deposit. And I didn't think much of it. I didn't think it was like one of the big checks. And we just waited in line and went to the teller, and he's an 18-year-old kid wearing, cargo shorts and some flip-flops. And he hands his check to this teller for $600,000. And she's so confused because who just puts that in their checking account? And she's like, hold on 1 second. So like she goes in the back and here comes the bank like manager or president. He's like, come in my office. And Scott's like, we got to get to the gym or, you know, the field. And he's like, no, we can't just, you know, deposit this like a normal check. So that was one of the times I was like, man, that's a lot of money right there. But
yeah. How is the guy who just got called up? How does his contract work with that?
Yeah, the minimum now in the major leagues is like $740,000.
Oh, so
prorate that over, what was that, a 5 or 6 month pay period? So divide that by the number of days. I mean, it's every once in a while I hear the number of what it is a day, and it's like, you know, what was that, $10,000 a day or something crazy? Maybe $8,000, whatever it is. It's there's commas getting thrown around now. Before that, I don't think you've seen many commas
in this. He probably gets a per diem too, right?
There's per diem. There's, I mean,
what's that like?
Ours here is like, you know, $20-$30 a day. In the big leagues, I think it's more, but they have to pay clubby dues. And that's the thing in the major leagues. You're making a ton more, but there's also more expenses. I mean, you're living in a big city and so things like that, but it's life changing money. And not to mention he'll forever have pension. You know, major league pension is real nice.
So you just have to get called up.
Yeah, 1 day of service time allows you to be into and their players union is one of the strongest unions in the world. And they have and there's tiers of certain number of years and fully vested is 10 years. But if you have 1 day, like when you're 55 or 65 or whatever, you're going to be able to.
So Bubella gets a pension?
Oh, yeah.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
I need to get him on, don't you think?
100.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That'd be an interesting chat.
Yeah.
He married a girl we went to high school with.
Yeah.
Heather Corder.
Yeah.
Three beautiful kids. Good for him.
So to your point where you start to see the money, maybe not in check form or like T-Mac carrying around straight cash, but some of these guys have so much money, it doesn't make sense. I mean, it's the Max Scherzers and Jacob deGroms that are making $40 million a year. Like, what does that look like? Or Keuchel. And we get a feel for it when they come to the minor leagues and they make a rehab start and we get what's called a big league spread. Like the rehabber will pay for our dinner at the clubhouse and they'll get a nice restaurant to bring in, you know, cater.
Is that just kind of understood? Cause like, what if you don't get a good dude down?
Every once in a while, there'll be a guy that'll like not do it. And it's word spreads pretty quick. Like you didn't get the spread. Like, I mean, even if it's a guy without much time, like he'll get in and out and the guys are like in and out. Like it's just something different than the norm. But when you get guys like Max and DeGrom, and so Max comes in and he gets like Perry's Steakhouse and we get steaks and it's like big deal and we have steaks. But then like a week after that, DeGrom came and like, what'd Max get? And we told him and he's like, we're going to get steak and lobster. And we're like, that's right. Yeah. You're the man, Jake. So DeGrom gets steak and lobster, I think, and pork chops from Perry's, and we have food as far as you can see. And it's wonderful. And then like a week or two after that, this is all last year, actually, Yamamoto, who signed for like $300 million with the Dodgers, did a rehab start in Round Rock for the Oklahoma City Dodgers team, which I'd never seen this. I'd never seen a guy pay for the other team's spread too. So he bought both team spreads and he found out what DeGrom did and he got all that plus the number one sushi restaurant in Austin to give like trays of, you know, the most high end sushi in Austin. So I was like, Yamamoto is the truth. So he won that one. So you see like this, I think found out from the club, like what it costs. And it's like a $15,000-$20,000, maybe $10,000. Either way, it's like a ridiculous amount to me. But we did the math one time with Dallas Keuchel, came to rehab in Oklahoma City and got our spread from Mickey Mantle's, which is the nice steakhouse across the street from the stadium in Oklahoma City. And we found out the total of it. And just for shits and giggles, we extrapolated or did the math for like our shortstop who was, you know, just a minor league. He wasn't a free agent yet. He's on the minor league pay scale. So he's making, let's say like $20,000 a year. Don't know what it is, but we did the numbers and like, what would it have been for Ryan Duro to spend of his salary to get our spread compared to what Dallas spent? Like how much of a hit was it for Dallas to go get a $10,000 spread? It came out to $2.75. So it would have been like Doro going out and like really like for the boys spending $2.75. So that gives you like scale of like what amount of money these guys have. But, you know, they're the best in the world.
Yeah, I remember when Dwight Howard signed with the Rockets, it was his first day in town, and he went to a restaurant downtown to eat breakfast, and he said he was going to get everybody's breakfast on him.
Mm-hmm.
And they put it on the front page of the Houston Chronicle.
Mm-hmm.
And as if he was the most generous person ever. And I remember doing the math, and it would have been like 46 cents to me.
Yeah. It's wild. It's wild. I'll never probably experience that, but you know, I'm grateful that I get to be around guys that do, you know.
Well, and it's easy to see how people could get jealous, right? Does that happen a lot?
I don't experience it, and maybe I don't like see it because I don't feel it, but I'm sure guys like, I assume in the major leagues, there's probably some comparative thoughts where it's like, no way that guy's making that because I'm better than him and I only make this, and everyone's trying to get what they're worth. But it's not a perfect, I mean, it is the free market open. I mean, teams are paying what they think a player is worth, and in baseball, you pay for past performance because if you are really good, they pay you hoping you're going to stay good. But if you're not, like, it's guaranteed. So there's guys that are making hundreds of millions of dollars that have been released by their teams because they're not producing. So it's not perfect, but I'm sure there is some jealousy that happens. There's guys that are, you know, looking around, wondering why aren't they getting theirs? Just like any other form of society.
Well, I remember when you were playing, you would say that guys would come in and watch highlights on SportsCenter and be like, I'm better than that guy.
100. And I was guilty of that. There was times where I would see Baseball Tonight and I'd see who had gotten called up on another team. I'm like, Joe Johnson? Like, come on. But that's to the point of like, Joe Johnson caught the break. He got the timing. The things lined up. The stars, someone got hurt. You know, there was a need and he could fill it. And, you know, when you're equally good or even better, like it's hard to see that sometimes. And there was times where even I would get like a little jaded or bitter, and you know, it's easily to fall into that, especially in AAA. Like it's such a unique ecosystem because of that, where guys are on their way down as older players, or they've been up and they didn't perform and they're back down. It's like, once you get a taste of that, like, this isn't quite as cool. And then there's kids on the way up that haven't gotten to the big leagues yet that are wide eyed and bushy tailed and love being in AAA. So there's this, it's like a front where tornadoes happen, where the cold and the warm hit each other. And as a staff member, like, you got to take that into account. Like, you kind of treat guys differently depending on, there's guys we have in AAA with 9+ years of major league service time. Like Tucker Barnhart, I'm not going to coach the same way I'm going to coach Cody Freeman, who's got 2 weeks in AAA. You know what I mean? So it's, which I think is cool. Like, I like the fact that there's such a mixture of a diversity of humans, you know, guys with wives and kids and millions of dollars, and got 22-year-old kids that are still clueless about life. So it's really, I think it's not really the minor leagues and it's not the major leagues. It's its own little island of humanity. It's really interesting to me.
What's your thought on Corey Seager? What's he like? And is he the biggest star in MLB?
Corey's an interesting dude. He's really cool. He's really smart, really engaging, but he's also hyper-focused. I mean, when it's time to go, and I don't think I even get to see that, because in the season, he's different than he is in spring training. I think in spring training, his guard's down a little more. He's a little more jokey, a little more, you know, jacking around with the boys a little bit. But from what I've heard and can see through television in the big leagues, he's a bit of a cyborg. I mean, he gets dialed in to where he takes his profession very, very seriously. And it can come off to people probably that he's
arrogant.
Yeah. But he's not. I mean, he's a very sweet and kind and, you know, humble. Like, he'll never show off his money or anything like that. Like, he's just about being great. And I think he wears that hard. I mean, he never wants to, I've heard him say, like, the fear of failure is what drives him. Like, he just doesn't want to fail, even if he's got a bunch of money. I think some people are subconsciously okay with failing if they've got $100 million, even if they don't admit it. Like, they're like, well, I'm good. Like, Corey's not good. Like, he's going to go and work his tail off to be good.
Is that a common thread that you see with greatness, like the level of focus that you talk about?
Yeah, I think the really good ones do have a way about, like, never taking off a pitch. I mean, their stamina to focus is really high, you know, whether it be on defense or offense. Like, they just don't get off the pedal. And sometimes that's a double-edged sword, and there's probably a point of diminishing return in some capacities where guys, like, maybe take too many swings, and there's only so much the body can handle, and you're taking 150 swings a day, and next thing you know, it's July, and your body's cooked, and now you got nothing left. So it's, you got to, as the adult in the room, as the coach, sometimes, like, we have to try to help temper that, you know, because they're very driven athletes, and there's a lot on the line. And sometimes you can overcook that. You can over focus and overwork and overtrain to where now your body can only handle so much.
Is he the biggest star in MLB? Probably the guy on the Dodgers.
Ohtani's for sure. I mean, he's a world sensation. Mookie Betts, Ohtani, Aaron Judge, bigger markets. I mean, I think Seager's a top 10 player in the MLB, but in terms of marketing and endorsements, I don't think Seager's up there with those guys.
How do those guys spend money to get even better since they have all this money? Do they do that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, Seager invests. He has his own personal hitting guy that he's on call. That guy's on call 24 hours a day. And when Corey wants to talk about his swing or video his swing or, you know, FaceTime his swing, this guy's there.
What do you think he pays that guy?
Probably a percentage point or two.
Wow.
So, you know, say it's 1% of his salary. Maybe it's 2%.
That'd be... So, didn't he sign for $300 million?
Yeah.
So, that'd be $3 million, 1%.
Yeah.
That's pretty good.
Yeah. So, I mean, I can't speak on it, but I know he invests, I'm sure, on... Yeah, a lot of them have chefs or cooks, or they pay attention to their diet. They all have strength and conditioning programs in the offseason they invest in. I mean, they're... With that much money on the line, they'd be dumb not to invest in themselves.
Yeah. You ever come across Ohtani?
Just playing against him or coaching on the other side of the lines, like in spring training. Never really met him or anything, but man, I remember when I first saw him hit BP when he was with the Angels, and we had Joey Gallo with us at the time, and I was filling in for a little bit in the big leagues in Anaheim. And Joey's the most power I've ever seen. And Joey was hitting BP up into, like, you know, parts of the stands in Anaheim I'd never seen hit. And I hung around to see the other team hit a little bit, especially Ohtani. And Ohtani was just first year coming over, was, you know, still kind of looked like a kid, was thin. And he started hitting balls further than Joey. And I was like, oh. And then I heard he's also the fastest guy on the field. And I was like, oh. And then I heard he threw 100. And I was like, oh, what's going on here? Like, this guy isn't human.
And where did this non-human come from? Like, do you know anything about his past?
I don't. Nothing particular. I'm sure I'll end up seeing a documentary on him or something. I don't know. I think he's blessed with genetically very strong body. And I know how they train in Japan. So he's probably trained a ton. And I think he's got a good mental approach to his game. And like, he's just the one in a million.
What's the difference in how they train for the big leagues in Japan versus here?
They rep. I mean, they put more time in. Their youth practices are 6 hours and ours are one or two. I mean, they really put a high premium on just straight reps. So I'm sure he grew up in that culture and environment where they just do more. And then when you get someone with his body frame that's done more, like, sometimes you get that. Not every time, but that's probably the formula.
One of my favorite stories of the last few years is when you got to be the interim manager and Max Scherzer was down.
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
Yeah. I'll be managing next week in El Paso. So one week, as staff members, we all get a week of vacation. So you pick your week and someone fills in for you, and I fill in for our manager. And it's always a wild week. I mean, it's a lot of work, and you're trying to do a job you're not that familiar with, and it's a lot that goes into it. So it's, some years have been really, there was one year we beat the best team in the league 4 out of 6 and like a couple walk-off wins. And, you know, it was like, this is great. And then the next year we played that same team, Oklahoma City Dodgers, and we lost all 6. And so like, you fill in and you just lose all 6 and you just feel terrible. So, but last year, Max came down and he's making a rehab start, which is a big deal because he's a massive investment. So there's a lot of like, you know, he can only throw this many pitches. He can only go this many innings. He's got to do this, that, the other. So everybody's kind of not on edge, but it's a big deal. And so.
And everybody knows all across the staff.
Yeah. And Max is prickly to start. I mean, he's a bear on the day he starts. Like, you don't talk to him. He's not very friendly when he's starting at his own. He'll admit that. And, you know, and he doesn't like to be taken out of game. So all the other staff members are like, you know, he's not going to let you take the ball from him on the mound, but like, I've got to take Max out of the game because our general manager says so. Like, I don't care what Max says, but let's see what happens. So I'm all in my head. I'm like, if I go out there and he's like, doesn't want to give me the ball, what do I do? Like,
how many pitches did he get that day?
He was slated to go 55 or 60 and he threw like 54. So in my mind, like, he probably knows. And if he wants one more pitch, like, but you can't let him start another at bat because if he goes a 10 pitch at bat, he goes over 60. And now, so you always kind of take him out before.
And what would happen to you if you let him go 65 pitches?
Oh my gosh. Like, it'd be a problem. No, I mean, you're going to get called by your superior, and there's, I don't know what the reprimand would be, but it's not something I want to experience. So I'm walking out to the mound to take Scherzer out of the game, and like you start overthinking it. You're like, do I grab the ball with my left hand? Because I want to give him a pat on the butt. And so you're like, all of a sudden, I'm like, where are my hands? But it was good. He was a pro. I mean, he gave me the ball. I patted him on the butt, and then he went to turn back. He walked by me, and he turned back around. I'm like, here it is. He's gonna give me some guff. I turned around, and he had the pitch com in his hat still that he wanted to give to the next pitcher. You know, the little thing that I don't know if you know about pitch com now. Catchers just push a button on their knee and it says in their ear what pitch is coming. They don't do fingers anymore. Yeah. So it goes in the side of the pitcher's hat, and sometimes they have to give it to the next guy. So he like turns back around, and I'm like, don't do it, Max. Don't do me like that. But, it all went well, but he did get me in Oklahoma City. He was rehab starting, and I knew this and I just forgot. Like, he doesn't like to be dapped up or high fived until his outing is over. It's just his thing. But as the bench coach, I'm top step. You know, when pitchers and players are coming off the field and they do something good, I'm like, that a boy, you know, pat on the butt, knuckles. And I wasn't even thinking. I wrote some notes. I look up and Max is right there, and he just threw like a, you know, 1-2-3 inning. I got a boy. You know, I go here with it.
He give you go?
Oh, yeah. Like, he was like, I don't do that. Like, he got fiery and like didn't give me knuckles and like, you know, big leagued me. I was like, that's right.
Yeah.
You
know, somebody's going to,
and then the whole
dugout
sees it. And then like the whole big league team and staff and front office is watching the game on TV, and the camera's on, you know, me on the top step. And I'm like, So he got me, but I'm like, whatever, Max. If
somebody's going to big league you, it might as well be a big leaguer.
Yeah. I was like, that'll make for a good story. But I get like text messages from like our coaches in the big leagues. They're like, we told you not to give knuckles to Max. And I was like, yeah, I forgot. Obviously.
You probably get big league more than anybody ever.
I guess the opportunities. Yeah. It didn't happen as much as you would think. I've garnered enough respect. And I probably don't go to the people that I know have that propensity.
Yeah. You know, like, hey, Seager, man, really enjoyed having you at spring training.
I actually had a friend, the guy I played in Japan with, Gary, I'm sure you heard me talk of, his son's like a massive Corey Seager fan, or just Rangers fan. He's like, you know, I get a picture signed. If I send you a picture of Corey, can you have him sign it and mail it back to me? And I was like, man, is there anybody else he likes? Because as cool as Seager is in spring training, you just hear stories of how he can be.
Well, you don't want to be that guy.
I don't. And it puts me in a tough spot when friends ask me to do that. So I'm like, is there anybody else that I just know I have a better relationship? Like Josh Young, I coached with the minor leagues. I can ask Josh a favor like that, and it wouldn't seem like weird, you know. And they're always getting asked for stuff, so you don't want to be that guy. And I'm not going to go up to him with a dozen balls and be like, "Hey, sign these dozen." Like it's always to somebody. They don't want to like anyway. So he said he likes Marcus Semien, and Marcus seemed in my mind easier to ask. So I went to Marcus, and Marcus was like, "Yeah, it was all good." But I was like, man. Why'd you have to ask for Corey's?
Yeah. Do you have any memorabilia or anything from T-Mac or Seager or somebody?
Funny you say that. I didn't do a very good job in my playing days. And even to this day, I don't ask for much. I could have some really cool stuff if I tried, but which other coaches and players do, and good for them. But I don't know. I don't think to do it. But one of the cooler things I have that's probably a one of one that no one else has that I think is pretty cool is a size 18 Adidas cleat. Signed by T-Mac. Yeah, might as well have been Shaq. Yeah, it was one of T-Mac's cleats, and he had big old feet, and he wrote to my son, and he signed it. So that's in my son's room, like along with Aaron Judge came over. I had one of our players is like his childhood or maybe best friend from minor leagues or something was with our organization, and we were going to the game, and I was going to watch BP, and I was like, could you tell Aaron to just walk over and just be like, say hi to my son? It's kind of a favor I asked of him, and he was like, absolutely. And I mean, he was like really cool about it. And Aaron, like Judge was like looking for me the whole time. And I was like, and he came over and I don't know what his buddy said to him about me, but he treated me with a lot of like respect. So it's,
I love that.
Respect is transferable. I'm sure I had treated this player that I asked a favor of really well. And we have a good relationship. It's actually Paul O'Neill's nephew, Michael O'Neill. Like he's a stud cat. And so Mike asked Aaron, and Aaron came over and I mean, he's massive, and he takes his batting gloves off and gives them right to Champ and signs them. And so Champ has these big old Mickey Mouse white gloves from Aaron Judge. So a couple things like that.
Yeah, that's cool.
Cool things.
So when we were in high school and you would get a call from a college coach or something, you and I would be the type to share good information with each other and get excited for each other.
Yeah.
And I never took it as bragging or anything, which is great. It's the truth, right? So share with me. I'll be excited for you. Does Champ do that sort of thing at school? Is he like, hey, I got Aaron Judge?
That's what's so cool about Champ. He doesn't do that at all. He never mentions it. And he even like...
Is that something you've instilled in him?
I don't know. I think he's just been around so much of the guy, so many of the guys, even when they were in like A-ball, like he sees them as more like teammates than like guys he looks up to. And also he thinks if his Yankees are probably his favorite team, but the Rangers is like a close second. But if you play for the Yankees, like you're on a different pedestal. So I could like introduce him to Adolis Garcia and he's like, hey, what's up, man? But if I introduce him to, you know, Gleyber Torres or some Yankee and a Yankee, it's like, that's a much bigger deal. And so it's like, say with Evan Carter, like he knows I coached Evan. And so Evan broke a bat and I was like, you mind if I had that? Can you sign it to Champ? And I give it to Champ and he's like, it's broken. I'm like, yeah, it's not for you to like, he's like, I want a bat to use. Like, I don't want to, like, he doesn't see it as like memorabilia. Like he's like, oh, this is, he has it in his room, but he's not going to go tell someone that he's got a broken bat from Evan Carter. Like he doesn't really talk to anybody about that. But like, if he's around like him and Josh Young or like pal around and, you know, that he's spent time with them in the clubhouse and certain players that, you know, he kind of knows on a friend level. And when Jake DeGrom was rehabbing last year, we had gone dove hunting that morning, you know, it was opening day of dove. So we walk in, you know, he's covered in dove blood and feathers and a knife on his hip and a cowboy hat on. And Jake's like, where you been, bud? Champ's like, oh, we're dove hunting. He's like, cool. Like, you know, I dove hunt in Florida. And so Champ says, I go get some food or do something. And like, 20 minutes later, him and Jacob DeGrom are still talking about hunting, you know, and Champ's talking about the deers he shot and the birds he shot. And so I'm like, who gets to go like dove hunting and then hang out with Jacob DeGrom talking? But Champ would never like go tell someone that he like hung out with Jacob DeGrom. I don't know. Like, he doesn't tell people like his dad coaches. He doesn't.
How do you know?
That's a good question. I guess we're around him enough and his friends to see like how he interacts. And like when they come to his room and they like start looking around his room, like they're like surprised to see he has those things. Like they didn't know. Like it's not like he told them at school and they're like, oh, here's the Aaron Judge gloves you told us about. They're like, what are these? These are Aaron Judge. He's like, yeah. He's more impressed with the antlers on his wall that he has four of now. He's got four deer heads on his wall. So I think he's just humble in that way. Like that's probably more from Sarah than me.
Especially at that age, yeah.
Yeah.
You didn't come to your humility until later in life.
Exactly. Yeah. You saw me at my full cockiness.
Do your parents still have memorabilia up on the second floor?
Yeah. They built up that like baseball room with the, you know, baseball on the wall, like the field, some of my jerseys and hats. Yeah. It's all still there. Yeah.
That's cool. All right. Let's do fun questions because you have to be at the field in about 45 minutes.
Yeah. Let's do it.
If you could create a new holiday that celebrates a unique aspect of human nature, what would it be?
Oof. I was listening to a podcast one time. It was some NFL player that I can't think of his name now, but he said something that I'd actually used for a little while and I liked it. He set a gratitude alarm every day to where he'd get a notification to like stop and be grateful for something. So I guess that stands out like a national gratitude day. Like, what are you grateful for? I feel like if everybody stopped and like thought about the blessings they have in their life, they'd probably be less likely to be rude or something to someone else. You know, it's still, you know, you put your problems on a table with everybody else's, you're probably going to grab yours back up pretty quickly. You know what I mean? No, give you a little perspective. Gratitude's never been a bad idea ever. So I guess to celebrate it would be probably a net positive for the whole world.
I think that would be my answer too, and maybe that's why we get along.
Word up.
Word.
Yeah.
If you could switch lives with somebody for a day on Monday, who would it be?
Ooh. Probably a really good baseball player, just to strap it on again, and not just strap it on as a career minor leaguer, but to strap it on as a, you know, let me be Ohtani or Judge for a day, just to dig in and know that you're like the best player on the planet and, you know, smash a couple baseballs and make some plays and throw a couple innings. I think that'd probably be what I would do. That or there's some people that get to hunt around the world as a profession that I think if I could be, you know, Jim Shockey is a famous TV hunter that goes around the world and hunts exotic animals and stuff. Someone's one of those two type people, you know, go either travel or smash baseballs.
Do you think Ohtani and Judge and Seager, do they get adrenaline rushes before the game, or do you think it's old hat by now?
I think they all have a sense of buzz in their body. And I remember when at the end of my career is when I didn't realize I had it until I didn't. You know, I didn't have the butterflies. And that's when I was like, uh-oh. Like, those butterflies are what let you know your things are about to go down. Like, so that you get those butterflies to fly in the right direction, you can do some magical stuff. So I think they probably do. To Corey's, I don't think much jazzes him up to where, like, he goes, like, where he gets lit, which was so cool to see him get lit in the playoffs. Like, when he hit, like, you know, it was a home run late in the season, I think, against the Astros that year, and he, like, showed emotion for the first time. And it, like, I feel like that show of emotion propelled the entire team to get hot through the playoffs, to where, like, this is our guy. It gives me goosebumps thinking about, like, and he's, like, he's a dog. Oh, he's not a robot. Like, this guy's, like, as competitive. I mean, not that no one thought he was uncompetitive, but – and then in the playoffs, when he hits that home run against the Diamondbacks, or I'm sorry, in the World Series, game one, where he tied it in the ninth, and then Adoles walked it off in the 11th. Like, we were at that game, and it was like, and you see the video of him hitting it, and before the bat even got to his shoulder, he's like screaming this, you know, primal scream where you're like, oh. But if he does that in June, it's like, I mean, it's old hat for him. But so I think they all do have that internal, like, there's a, absolutely, you can't play a high level of baseball and not have a pretty hot fire.
So they used to take greenies, like, back in the 70s, 80s. Do they take caffeine or anything to get them going?
I mean, there's guys that probably take some pharmaceutical help, but there's probably guys that take caffeine. I mean, I don't know who does what, but I think that everyone's looking for a little jolt when you're playing 150 games in 160 days. There's P4, pre-workout. I mean, all of our guys are, you know, getting up for games, you know, in a legal way, whatever legal way they can do to get up and be at their best, they do it.
Because the penalty is so stark, right?
If you get caught. Yeah, you're not doing anything that would be, where you could be tested or get caught, because you get really hammered.
Do they get tested frequently?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, testing all the time. It's random. And they'll come once a homestand, and it'll be four random names, and next homestand it'll be, you know, something like that. It's not a full team thing.
What's the coolest thing anybody's ever done for you? I should maybe exclude your wife. That way, you know, we might feel obligated to.
Yeah, she's my rock and right hand man who's done a ton for me. Just off the top of my head, I'm sure I'll think of 10 after this is over. But our president of the Round Rock Express and owner took Doug, our manager, and I to our owners, Reed Ryan, who's Nolan Ryan's son, took us to Nolan Ryan's ranch in November of last year and got to hunt on a 3,000 acre, unbelievable ranch with all kinds of game. And we all got to, you know, shoot a trophy animal. And so that was a pretty, pretty darn kind gesture to get to experience something like that.
Did you get to mount it?
Yeah, I shot a whitetail, Doug shot an Axis, and then Doug's son-in-law, who also plays in the major league, shot a Sika, which is an exotic type deer. I just did a European mount, which means it's not the whole, like, shoulder and neck. It's just the skull and the antlers, which I prefer. But yeah, it's on the wall.
Tell me about his ranch.
It's super cool because it has history, which makes it even cooler. You know, it's called Fort Terra. It was an actual fort in the 1800s for our military to fight, I guess, the Mexicans when we were kind of fighting for our independence. And it was, you know, Indian raids would happen there. And there's Indian, like, caves with Indian writings on the wall. And the structure is still the same. And it's the, like, you know, you picture a fort with the cedar fence around it. I mean, it looks like a fort from the 1800s. And they've kind of preserved it. And what's cool is that Nolan didn't want to change it. And so you go inside, and the family, it was owned by us, like, one family for 100 years up until Nolan bought it. I guess he was in a bidding war with, like, Matthew McConaughey or something. And Nolan got it for a lower price because he was not going to touch the structure, and he wasn't going to replace the staff that had worked there for generations. You know, the cook and the ranch manager and all that. So he kept it as is, and the furniture that family had in there, which was beautiful, but it's from, like, the 1970s. So you walk into this lodge, and it's like this floral pattern, huge couch with these, like, you know, it looks like you're stepping back in time, which is like such a cool experience. And it's not high fenced. It's not managed to have like trophy animals. It's not been stocked with, bought animals with tags in their ears. It's like purely wild, 3,000 low fence acres with, you know, indigenous axis and cyca and pigs and whitetail and turkey. And it's like this wonderland, and it's on the water, and it's, I mean, it's got a river going through it, and it's a magical place. I mean, it's so such a cool experience. The coolest part I'll tell you about was that there was a water well that they dug in the 1860s that they expanded the fort around that well, and now it's indoors. But at the coffee table in the middle of like the game room is a well that goes down like 100 feet. So it's just this black well with a light that goes down, and now it's a coffee table with a glass top. And, you know, there's two bulls on the wall that were given to him by the Rangers when he retired, and one's named Robin and one name's Ventura. You know, little stuff like that where you're like, who has longhorns on their wall named after a big leaguer that you punch in the face? Like, and then on the wall is a picture of his dog that George W. Bush painted for him. Like, so you're in a place with things that, you know, are one of ones. So little things like that was such a, it was such a kind gesture to have Reed, you know, and Chris Almendarez let us go experience that.
And where is it?
It's out in Junction, the west of Austin, about 2.5 hours, Junction. So it's more like West Texas.
If you could turn any activity into an international thing that you think you'd be competitive in, what would that be?
Where are you getting these questions? Your big brain ears, or are you Googling these things?
It's funny you ask, because half of these questions come from me prompting AI. What questions would Brad D'Antonio ask that he's never asked before?
Wow. The things I'm good at, and I think I'd be competing, I think already are international. Like, I think of archery. Like, I'm a good archer, but I think that's already international. Like, I'm decent at ping pong, baseball. Like, the things I'm good at are already international. So, what things aren't international? What's only American?
Well, one guy said pickleball, because it's not an Olympic level sport.
Oh, yeah.
It could be storytelling. You're a great storyteller.
Yeah, there was like an international storytelling competition.
Yeah.
And every country sent their best one. Yeah, I think that'd be down. I'd be down for that.
Yeah, you truly are. We talked about this at breakfast, but you were telling a story about some of your coaches and how they listen to a story, and you observe one of them doing X, and I'm like, that's why we get along, because I notice that sort of.
You got to be able to read the room, and like, I'll cut a story short if it's not, if I don't feel like people are engaged. Like, I'm not trying to hear myself talk, but if people are leaning forward and laughing, and you know, I'll drag it out, you know, and start adding details, not making it up, just adding details to build a better, paint a better picture, and you know, the punchlines land a little better. So it's. I think I was trying to think of where I got that. I remember watching Cash would tell stories. You know, Cash was a good storyteller, my brother. And I think my dad was always telling stories. So somewhere in there, and then you live a life that I've lived of, you know, minor league shenanigans and travels, and you see things. And I actually took a note in my, I have to show you myself. I think I showed you last time when you were here. Like, I started finally listing out all the stories from, so I don't like at least forget the titles of them. To where someday maybe I'll put them all together in some sort of book, but there's a lot of them. My kids love them. My daughter can't every night she's like, tell another one. I'm like, geez, like it's not endless stream here. Like but I'll get them laughing, and they are the best audience, because like they'll stop and they'll ask questions, and then like Stella will chime in with her own take on it, and like she cracks herself up. So she starts like, she'll cut me off, but it's in a good way, because like she's just like laughing so hard and adding, you know, her own points to it. And so I love telling them stories.
I love telling my daughter stories too, but she's only 4. She interrupts me and asks a lot of questions.
Just wait till they get a little older. It's so fun. It's fun at 4 too, but.
Yeah. So what I do with her is I will tell a true story, because it's hard to come up with your own story on the fly. And then, so I'll say, I moved to Houston and I met, or I usually say it's a boy. A boy met another boy at this all-ages club called Shelter, and he was impressed with his confidence and energy, and then they did everything together. And then at the end, like, you'll marry a girl that you met in a small town in New York, and they got married in a castle in Europe, And then they had a baby. And she starts squealing.
Yeah.
So any story I tell, it might be real. But then as long as I end it with them getting married in a castle,
yeah,
she loves it.
Yeah, that's great. Actually, I didn't have a story to tell. Instead, I just make one up. And I didn't know. Come to find out, I can actually make up a story. I started just going off on like this guy met a mermaid and they went in the water and he came out. And
then
because Stella was wondering like, do fish know they're in water? And like until they get caught and get brought out into the air, they're like, and then the fish goes back in the water. And it's like, guys, there's a whole other world above that. And like, you know, what does a fish think when they get caught and pulled out? And so like, tell this whole story about this guy going in a lake with a mermaid. And you know, like 20 minutes later, I finished a story that had all these twists and turns and like actually had like, it was a good story. And I was like, well, I guess I can make up stories too. But Stella loved it.
Yeah. I'm the same way. I'll mix in like Rapunzel's hair and mermaids. And this mermaid got out of the water, but she had never eaten a hamburger. And I just come up with stuff.
Yeah. You just make it silly and they think it's hilarious.
They love it.
Yeah.
All right. So what's the most valuable piece of advice you've ever gotten?
I can't remember if it's actually someone saying it or me reading it, but like you, I like quotes, and there's something about, it's about the journey, not the destination, which kind of ties into be where your feet are, you know, staying present. The present is the present, you know, the future is uncertain. The past can't be changed. So I think there's something about being present and in the moment resonates with me. I think as a baseball player, like it's a nightmare if you're not. And so you're really trying to just like, win this next pitch. And if you start to think about the next pitch after that, or you're thinking about your last swing, like things can go off the rails. So I think I got really good at just being in the moment. That's where the flow state happens. That's where your subconscious talents come out best, your creativity, your athletic capabilities come out. So I think, you know, somewhere along the way, I either read it or someone told me to just be present, be in the moment, trust yourself, you know, kind of let go. And I'm thinking in hitting terms and playing baseball, like how hard it is to let your talents come out and get out of your own way.
One of the things I'm keenly aware of is that I can talk about politics without worrying about too much consequence. And I say that because I know people with regular jobs can't do that or don't feel comfortable doing it. Not that you have a regular job, but do they ever talk politics in the clubhouse?
You'll hear it. You'll hear the guys, but the clubhouses I grew up in, it was like family, stats, and religion. You didn't talk about it. And I think politics would probably fall into that. Like you don't talk about someone's family. You don't talk about someone's stats. You don't really get too much into religion. I think politics would fall in that same category where we got a mix of people here and there's 25, 30 of us in a close, confined area and you don't want to step on any toes, but you'll hear guys say some things and I don't really get into it. There's something beautiful about the baseball clubhouse that it doesn't see color. It doesn't see regions. I mean, there's people from all over and everybody has a story and there's so much mutual respect and camaraderie that it's like the last bastion of together. And I don't know, like there's something really, really cool about a clubhouse that, and you experienced it, I'm sure, in college where it just cuts through a lot of the BS. So you don't want to add into it. So you don't hear it much, to answer your question.
Surely there are guys that talk about stats more than others.
You don't talk about someone else's stats. You could be saying like sweet mustache or like, you know, your body looks like a melted candle or, you know, you can like bag
that
on guys.
That first one applies to me, right?
I mean, there's other guys with mustaches besides you, but yours is sweet.
But the melted candle
thing. No, that's not you. Okay. That's not you. So I went from you to someone else, but you've never had a melted candle except for that one picture you took in the Delt House at Texas.
You remember that?
Yeah.
I've talked about that. Yeah, I was so disgusted.
I've heard
I
you.
Vowed never to look like that ever again.
That's why I brought it up. Yeah. So you can rag like that, as you know, in the clubhouse, but as soon as like someone hits you with something and you're like, at least I'm not batting 212, like, skeet.
Oh,
like, man. Now we're like, you went over the line. Or you talk about someone's girlfriend or their wife or their sister or their mom, or you talk about, you know, someone's religion. Like, if you start trying to bag on someone's faith, like, it's probably not going to go over well. But the clubhouse, you can't really bag on people. So that's where there's got to be kind of boundaries set.
Has there been a fist fight?
I've seen some, yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
Does that ever get out in the media?
You'll hear about it sometimes, maybe. It should stay in-house. I think in the big leagues, it's just hard because there is media in the clubhouse, but there's things happen in the minor leagues that, you know, it's all handled in-house.
Mm. If the president, Trump, asked you for your best advice, what would you tell him?
Pertaining to him or pertaining to, like, policy?
If he just said, Chase, I'm glad you came to see me in the Oval. Man, what what do you think I'm doing all right? Like, what should I be doing to, if I can improve your life and people like you?
I'd probably tell them to, like, tweet less. Like, I'd just be like, you know, you have such good policy. Like, stand on that. You don't need to respond to every person. You know, he's very reactionary, and he'll, like you said, he doesn't start anything, but if people come at him, he comes back at him. But I don't think some things he can let lie, like it's not worth it, in my opinion, but he probably wouldn't listen. But maybe that's what makes him beloved by people, because he doesn't back down. He always speaks his mind. So, like, what do you want to give up? But I don't think it's necessary. I think it's a waste of his really precious time.
If you could have breakfast with one person tomorrow, who would it be?
Probably my mentor that passed away last year, Uncle Chuck, Charles Jeunesse. You know, he's just a big part of who I am today, and so it'd always be good to just see him again.
How did that relationship start? Like, if somebody wanted a mentor, how did they go about finding it?
He kind of found me. I didn't know I needed one or wanted one or even had one until a few years after I had known, but he picked me to mentor, and I'm grateful he did. I think finding them is starts with curiosity and not being afraid, especially older people. Like, as a young person, like, I don't know how I had the, like, courage to just go hang out with a 60-year-old man and, like, have a meal with him and not be uncomfortable. Maybe it was partly because he was such a cool cat, but I don't know. I think you're just open to people and open to other people's ideas and their wisdoms. And I think it starts with all learning starts with, I don't know. So if you think you know it all, you're probably not going to find a mentor. So if you're perpetually curious and wondering about life, think the world will open up to you. You know, when the student's ready, the teacher will appear. But if you think you got it all unlocked, then not many teachers are going to come your way.
You told me about a stock last year, or last time you were on the, I think last time we had breakfast, you told me about Kava.
Yeah.
You still own it?
I do. I don't think it's as high as it was. It's a lot of things have come down, but I still do. Yeah.
I want to say it's tripled since we spoke about it
first. Possibly. Yeah.
I think it's at like 96 a share.
Yeah.
What's the best quality a wife can have?
I think in general, I love consistency. I like whatever you are, be that, so I know where to meet you. You know, it's when you have teammates or people that are like one way one day and another way the next. Like, I think that, and I think there's so many good qualities she has and so many good qualities that a wife should have. You know, they're patient and kind and forgiving and loving and compassionate and caring and empathetic. Like, there's a bunch of them.
Yeah, I think when you're looking for consistency, though, you're probably looking for more of a man, because our emotions don't take us.
That's a good point.
As far as theirs.
Yeah. But to her credit, she's pretty consistent. I mean, comparatively speaking, maybe other women are less. I don't know.
Well, one of the things that's always impressed me about Sarah that you've talked about is that she will apologize after the fact.
Mm-hmm.
Like, sorry, I was out of my mind for a minute there or something. Yeah.
She's good. She's got good self-evaluation skills. She's very accountable. Like, she'll, you know, have no problem saying she's wrong, but she's also very strong in her conviction. So when she doesn't think she's wrong, you're probably not going to move her off that stance.
You know, I would say the majority of my friends send their kids to private school.
Yeah.
You send yours to private school.
Yeah.
I would say to a man, they complain about their private school.
Maybe it's what you're paying, and, you know, when you get money involved, the return on investment is probably different than if you're just going to the public school and you're like, it is what it is. But if you pick a school and you're paying for it, you probably expect a certain level of education and different things. But I mean, as a whole, I think that, you know, their foundation and their faith is what we were most concerned about. And the fact that they're being taught by sisters and nuns, I think that has made an impact on them, and I see it in them and their character, along with obviously me and Sarah raising them a certain way. But they've got a really strong foundation, which is what we were most concerned with, or, you know, that's what we're investing in.
So do people ask for autographs like they used to, or is it all selfies now?
No, it's a lot of autographs. They ask for a lot of that. Kids now are bold and audacious. I'll tell you that. I mean, they ask for your Oakleys, your glove, your bat, your hat, and they're not like, no please or thank yous. It's like, give me your hat. Like, I mean, you want my wallet too? Like, what are you talking about? Like, give me a ball. Like, where are your parents? There's some kids I've been like, are your parents close? Yeah. Yeah, they're right here. I'm like, manners matter. I think you should teach your son some manners, because he doesn't say please or thank you. And he's not going to get a ball like that, because it's always the kid that doesn't, it's either, you know, not asking, or he's asking politely. Those are the ones that will actually get the ball. But it's crazy. They'll come right in our dugout, stick our head in, and start barking for guys to give them stuff. And I'm like, I went to a college or pro game. I would just like watch guys walk by. Like I was just like enamored with a college or pro player. I would never even think to talk towards them.
What do you think does that? Is it interactions on social media?
There's, I mean, you tell me. It's the entitled, because they're just more entitled. Maybe they have more access to see behind the scenes, and they think they know pro players because they've seen them on the Instagram. I don't know. That's a good question.
Yeah, I've had people act like they know me, but they probably do because they've heard me talk so much.
Yeah, I'm not sure what it is, but it can get. Don't want to be annoyed by a kid, but when you see kids with no manager, like, come on, man. Like,
what's your take on travel ball? Your kid plays travel ball, right?
Yeah, I don't love it. It's like you're kind of boxed into what your options are, though, with the way it's set up now. And if you want to have your kid playing against a good level of competition, you got to kind of pay for it. And the things come with that. And it's along the same lines of when you're paying for something, you have higher expectations. And when they don't meet it, it just aggravates you even more. But it's, you do your best. You know, you do your best to get your kid opportunities to play and develop. And, you know, that's sometimes it can be frustrating, but I mean, baseball in general is frustrating, right?
Yeah. Where do you spend your time online now? That's not social media.
I read a lot of baseball stuff. I read or watch hunting stuff. I mean, I don't spend a lot of time online, I guess. Like I read books. So that's not.
What are you reading now?
Why We're Catholic. Like it's a Catholic book. I haven't read any like hitters though lately, like really like good books that I would recommend to other people. But I'm trying to think of what I do online. I look at stats. I like baseball stats. I check out how players are doing.
Your basic math must be really good because of that.
Yeah, probably.
Like if I say 3 divided by 8.
Well, no. That's no? Less than 1.
I mean, I could be 5, right?
3. Oh, 8. Shoot. I'm sorry. Yeah, yeah. Batting average. Yeah, you're right. 3 divided by 8. I didn't even think about it in those terms. Yeah. I guess you're right. 375. Yeah, not bad.
I guess you don't.
I guess I don't. They do the math for you on the stats I look at. I'm just looking at the final. I'm not with a calculator setting, you know, figuring them out.
Anything else you want to talk about? Because you got a good field in about
20 minutes. I could talk about my book for a sec.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The Hitter's Handbook.
The Hitter's Handbook.
My boy's an author now.
I mean, that sounds weird.
I know. I bet.
But it's true.
You did a great job on it. Thanks. I haven't read all the way through it, but I appreciate the copy you sent me.
You probably heard it all. So, like, it's a lot of the stuff that...
I tell my friends that a lot. Like, you don't need to listen to the podcast because you hang out with me.
Yeah, exactly.
You hear all these stories.
That's what I tell people. I'm like, you've heard all this, but if you want to read it, great. But I appreciate it. I like that it just, there's all the stuff in my head is actually out there now for someone else to consume that has interest in, you know, knowing how I went about it and how high level hitters think. You know, it's not exact. You don't have to, I mean, everybody has their own way of doing things, but I feel like when I was trying to figure out my best version, I was just trying to ask how other people, you know, did it and patch together my own version. So if it could help somebody else grab a brick and put it in their foundation of their processes on being a hitter, then I consider it a win, which is why I wanted to write it and get it out there, because I think a lot of kids are chasing, you know, unicorns. You know, they're chasing some magic swing that they think is going to make them a great hitter, and that it's just not that mechanics aren't important, but there's just a whole lot more to hitting than a pretty swing.
What's the best testimonial or blurb you've gotten?
I think the second edition where I got Josh Young wrote the quote on the back, just saying that, you know, I can't remember exactly how I said it, but a big part of hitting is having a process to give you clarity and confidence to go to the plate. And Chase explains exactly how that works for a high level hitter. But I mean, I've gotten some really good feedback from guys. I just got one two nights ago of a coach that's with another organization that's using a lot of the material to coach their like low level players in the Dominican Republic. You know, that there's to think there's some Dominican 16-year-old Dominican that's hearing about competing with clarity and having a plan and an approach, and you know, and using my verbiage to build up his process. I think that's pretty cool. That's international.
And it's really cool to produce something and then get residual benefits later. I experienced some of that with the blog. And you know, something I think about in the podcast, something I think about a lot is people have written, like writers have written so much, but then a lot of times they're only known for one or two things that they've produced that was good. And so I know how much time I've put into writing, and some people will just know the how to pass a shit test article because mm-hmm. it's been read probably twice as much as the second most mm-hmm. read article. Mm-hmm. So you could spend time, thousands of hours of your life, but then you say this one thing or write this one paragraph that sticks with people forever and you never know what that's going to be.
That's the coolest part. And there's times where I've coached guys who I didn't think I was getting through an inch of their thick head. I mean, they look at you, look right through you, and you're like, man, I'm not moving the needle at all on this guy. And you fast forward 5 years and they like get to the call to the big leagues with another organization or something. And they write to you and say like, you told me this and it helped me get to the big leagues. And you're like, I did. And I think back to my career, there's a couple like 10 second conversations that changed the arc of my career. And it wouldn't be anything like mind blowing, but for that time and space to hear those words from that person and my certain level of maturity, like, boom, like,
yep.
Oh, like you got to be ready to hit. I had a coach tell me that in double A and I was like, of course I'm ready to hit. And he's like, no, you're not. And I'm like, hey, I'm not. You know, like you start to think, like ask the internal questions that allow you to think about your processes and to evaluate yourself and your mentality and your mind. Like just that one like call out, he called me out. He's like, you're not ready to hit. And I was like offended at first, but it also made me like question it. And now, oh, and that's where that whole thing started. It's where the whole book began was, you know, what is my mentality? What is my plan? What is my approach? Where am I going? What's my clarity? Do I have it? Or am I just up there like hoping to get a hit, rolling dice at the casino? Am I just hoping to land on something? You know, and hope's a terrible game plan. Like that's only base. You're living off of your physicalities, which at some point you won't be the best physical player on the field. So what are you going to do then? You're done. So if you don't have this process in place to separate yourself through your clarity and your conviction, your trust and your confidence, you just get beat up. You get bullied. And it's like, and I was at that point in time where I was not mentally clear, even though I was physically and I was competitive and I had a fighter spirit, but it was like, I wasn't on the track. I was just all Ferrari driving on the lawn.
Yeah. You've encountered so many people throughout your career that you respect that it's probably helped you to become more self-aware and like objectify yourself.
Yeah.
Do you impart that on players?
I think self-evaluation is a big part of it. Now, you'll come across players this day where I'm like, this is not a good self-evaluator. And it kind of hurts them. It also sometimes kind of helps them because I also say the sixth tool is delusion. There's a healthy level of delusion in baseball that can get you through some times where like I was a little too pragmatic at times or a little too logical. We're like, I'm bad. But some guys like, I'm just not hitting right now or something. You know, like it was – so you see all types of mental – approaches to it, and there's not right and wrong, but I will say that clarity creates composure. And if you want to be composed on the field, you better have a plan that you trust, even if your plan is to think about pink elephants, like, all right, like that's yours, like I can get behind that. But if you can't just tell me like I'm just up there seeing what happens, like maybe there's a few people that can do that, but I think if you really dug into their actual brain and what they're thinking, it would be more than what they're articulating.
How could people buy the Hitter's Handbook?
Hittershandbook.com. There's a Facebook Hitter's Handbook. There's Instagram. There's Twitter. So you can find it online.
Is it
the Hitter's Handbook.com? Yeah.
No, you can't put an apostrophe.
Wait,
in a URL.
It might be Hitters. I don't know. I don't know the title of the book is the Hitter's Handbook. I'm trying to think of the website. It might just be Hitter's Handbook, but it's, I mean, you type one of those in and I'm thinking some things will pop up, but yeah, it's out there.
And if somebody wanted to contact you?
I'm on Facebook, I'm on Instagram, and I'm the only Chase Lammett in America, so
I think
I'm not hard to find.
Yeah, I think I'm the only Brad D'Antonio in America, too. The other day, I was at the co-working space, and this girl, she's like 21, she shows me to my office every day, and she was introducing me to this new guy, and I forgot what his name was as we were walking to the office, so I said, what's the new guy's name again? And she goes, Jose. And I said, Jose Martinez? And she goes, are you saying that because he's Hispanic? And I said, well, yeah, that. And that's my father-in-law's name. So I was just curious.
Yeah.
Because I wouldn't want a name that everybody else has.
Yeah.
So it's nice to have a unique name.
Yeah, I love that. I don't think I've ever met anybody that's been like, hey, buddy. Like, they're always like, hey, Chase. And I'm a big bud guy, which I feel bad about because I
overdo buddy too.
Well, if I can't remember someone's name, if their name's Matt and, you know, we go, you know, I haven't seen him in 10 years. I'm like, hey, bud. But I don't think anyone that I remember is they're always like, hey, Chase. I'm like, oh, I'm so glad I have a name that's not like easily forgettable.
Did you think about that when you named your kids?
Yeah, I wanted them to have a unique name, but Champ's real name is Chase.
Oh, I didn't know that.
On the birth certificate.
Middle name is Champ?
Nope. His middle name is Goodrich. Sarah's maiden name. Champ's just a nickname.
Huh.
Yeah.
Very good. I don't have anything else.
I'm sure you do, but we gotta go.
Love you, dude.
Love you too.
Friends, if you enjoyed this episode, copy the link and share it with a friend. You can find me on the socials at @man_overseas. If we can do anything for you, let me know. Otherwise, we'll talk back at you soon. Thank you.